It's 11 o'clock. Time for another story from Anthony Bilbo.
Hello again. Today's story is called Never Too Late. Albert Cruikshank sat at his desk in the office and made the same vow that he made every summer. He's not going to make me late for my holiday this year. And just like every year, he really thought he could keep his vow. Albert Cruikshank, with the firm some 20 years, had been assistant dispatch manager for 10 of them. At least, assistant dispatch manager was how he liked to think of himself, and that was how he described himself to his few acquaintances outside the firm. But more accurately, he was assistant to the dispatch manager. And even this small dignity was denied to him most of the time because Mr. Smalldean, the dispatch manager, always referred to him as my man Cruikshank to customers and as old Cruikshank within the department. I'll get my man Cruikshank to look up the details for you. Or, Miss Cardew, get old Cruikshank to come in here. Mr. Smithers wants to place an order. 9 years earlier, Mr. Cruikshank had tried to persuade the firm to manufacture a new line. As a hobby, he made plaster birds and garden ornaments in the shed at the bottom of his landlady's garden in Potter's Bar. His suggestion had been put forward to the board of directors, and, receiving special favour from Mr. J.R. Bridlake, the managing director himself, was approved for trial. For a few months, Albert Cruikshank had had high hopes for his future with the firm. But the sample range of plaster birds didn't sell very well, and no more were made. Of course, I know why they didn't sell, Albert said to Miss Cardew, a younger and more admiring Miss Cardew in those days. Look at this one. No artistry, no finish, no character. I've always found, I make them myself as a hobby, you know, I've always found that the eyes of a bird are terribly important. Do you know what I mean, Miss Cardew? Oh, yes, I do, Mr. Cruikshank. This one's got no sparkle. It's not chirpy enough. Exactly, Miss Cardew. Of course, I had hoped when I made this suggestion that I might have more say in their manufacture. You really should have made a fuss, Mr. Cruikshank, when Mr. Smalldean sent it through as his own idea. You should really. I nearly said something myself. Sometimes in the years that followed, 9 years in which Mr. Cruikshank grew thinner and a little bald, and Miss Cardew smiled less often and changed her hairstyle not at all, Mr. Cruikshank wondered what might have happened if, bolstered up by Miss Cardew's admiration and indignation, he'd gone to Mr. Bridlake and told him just why the plaster birds weren't selling and whose idea it had been in the first place. Still, he couldn't complain, really. His job was safe and he wasn't badly paid. Anyway, he was too old to change horses now. 48, and still Smalldean's assistant. Not even any good dreaming of stepping into his shoes when he retired. By the time Smalldean reached retiring age, the directors would be bound to appoint a much younger man to take over. Another 17 years of travelling in the rush hour, arriving always 10 minutes before time, and leaving 15 minutes after everyone else had gone home in the evening. And yet, nobody seemed to appreciate his punctuality. Indeed, he sometimes felt they laughed at him for it. Even Mr. Bridlake, the managing director. He'd once overheard him talking to Mr. Smalldean in the corridor. How's our Albert these days? Still able to set your watch by him? Old Cruikshank, sir? Oh, yes. 10 to 9 every morning he plods in, and 6:15 he plods out again. Yes, said Mr. Bridlake. Our Albert's always been rather a plodder, I'm afraid. Otherwise, I might have... That was all Albert Cruikshank had heard, but it was enough. Always a worrier, the managing director's comment had provided him with weeks of gloomy fretting. The remark, and the tone in which it had been delivered, translated in his mind as poor old Cruikshank, who would never amount to anything. How could he? A man who was called a plodder. A man so unimaginative and dull that you could set your watch by his comings and goings. A man who never took more than 3/4 of an hour for lunch. A man who always checked his figures twice. A man who never said boo to a goose. At 3:25, he closed his books, wiped his 3 pens, one black, one red, and one blue, and put them away in the drawers of his desk. He locked the drawers, took the keys into Miss Cardew, who wished him a pleasant holiday, said goodbye rather stiffly to the 2 20-year-old girls who frightened him a little, and shook hands cheerfully and comfortably with old Bert. Bert winked at him and said, "Don't do anything I wouldn't do, Mr. Cruikshank." Bert said this every year, but every year it made Mr. Cruikshank feel a bit of a dog and made his last wave to the girls a little easier. He went back to his own office to collect his suitcase. Through the frosted glass of the partition that separated his small room from Mr. Smalldean's large one, he could see the shadow of the manager look up as he walked over to his desk.
Cruikshank, come in here a minute, will you?
He knew it. He put down his suitcase and went into Mr. Smalldean's room. "Ah, Cruikshank, I know you're going on holiday today, and I don't want to hold you up. I just want to check over these figures with you. Never was any good at adding up." Mr. Cruikshank laughed dutifully at this witticism. Of course, the real joke was that Smalldean couldn't add up. Hysterically, Mr. Cruikshank waited for the inevitable second line. "Of course, I'm an administrator, not an adding machine." "Well now, Cruikshank, I mustn't keep you. What time's your train go?"
4:15, Mr. Smalldean, and I've still got to get my ticket."
4:15? Oh, plenty of time. Trouble with you is you worry too much. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. You pay too much attention to detail. If you want to get on in this world, you've got to take a broader view. See the whole picture, not just a small part of it. How do you think I'd be able to run an important department like this if I fussed over every detail? Delegation of authority, that's the secret. 4:15, you say? It'll take you 10 minutes to get to Waterloo, 10 minutes to get your tickets, 15 minutes at the outside. There you are, you see? I can attend to detail if I have to. The point is, Cruikshank, I only attend to those details that matter. Now then, these figures. At 4:05, Albert left for the station, and by the time he'd bought his ticket and found the platform, the 4:15 to Bexhill had gone. Mr. Cruikshank sat down on a bench in the waiting room and studied the advertisement on the wall opposite. Ah, there was Bexhill, and Mr. Cruikshank thought with satisfaction that it looked just as inviting as it always did, although he'd never seen that girl on the poster there in all the years he'd been going to Mrs. Chapman's boarding house. "She's a model," said the man on the other side of the fireplace.
I beg your pardon?"
He was a fat, jolly-looking man with a large wicker basket balanced on his chubby knees. "That girl on the poster, she's a model. I've seen her on the telly, too."
"Oh, really?"
said Mr. Cruikshank, and pretended to look for something in his briefcase. But the fat man didn't seem to notice. "Going on holiday, then?"
Yes.
"Thought so. Let me guess now. Bexhill?"
"That's right. How did you guess?"
"Well, it's a bit of a hobby of mine, studying people. Now, take you, for instance. Dark suit, rolled umbrella, even though there's not been a spot of rain all day, looking at a poster about Bexhill, and a suitcase on the floor beside you. I'd say you work in an office in the city, you're going on your yearly holiday with pay, you wear drip-dry shirts, and you're a bit reserved, as you might say."
"Oh? How do you arrive at drip-dry shirts?"
Mr. Cruikshank was a bit nettled. "Easy. Only one suitcase. No room for a fortnight's supply of ordinary shirts."
Yes, said Mr. Cruikshank, but take another point. You say I'm reserved. How do you know?"
"Easy again. When I first spoke to you, you rummaged about in that briefcase of yours, hoping I'd shut up and leave you alone. And I know for a fact that all you've got in there is a packet of railway sandwiches, because I looked. I'm nosy, you see. Proper old Nosy Parker. That's a bit of a joke, you see, because me name's Parker."
"Oh, well, how do you do, Mr. Parker? Glad to make your acquaintance. My name is Cruikshank."
From being annoyed at the interruption of his private thoughts, Mr. Cruikshank became expansive in the fat man's company. All his reserve vanished as wave after wave of fat laughter came from Parker's gargantuan body. He began to feel that he must be something of a wit. Parker laughed so much at Mr. Cruikshank's description of his last conversation with Smalldean.
Oh dear," said Parker. "You sound a proper old fraud to me. But these birds, now, what do you make them out of?"
"Plaster. A very special sort of plaster, of course."
"Oh, yes, of course. Now, if I was you, and was as miserable at me work as you are, do you know what I'd do? I'd chuck the old thing, sink what capital I might have in about a ton of plaster and paint and so on, and start selling plaster birds off my own bat."
"Well, it's a pleasant pipe dream, I agree, but
That's about all it'll ever be, I'm afraid.
Oh, no capital?
Well, I've got a bit put by, of course. But no, what I really meant was that if a large organization like mine couldn't sell them, what chance would one man have?
Well, you said the reason they didn't sell was because they didn't make the eyes bright enough. And there's nothing like working for yourself, you know. It's a wonderful life.
Is that what you do?
The fat man eased his body into a more comfortable position.
It's what I did. I'm retired now, but I've had 5 businesses altogether, one after the other. And one after the other, they all failed.
How dreadful, said Mr. Crookshank.
Don't you believe it? Whenever things looked a bit gloomy, I always said to myself, something will turn up. And it always did. Usually the bailiffs. No, that was just my little joke. He never come to actually having the bailiffs in. And anyway, as I said, something always turned up. After the sweet shop, before the First World War, I met my first wife. And she got a tidy sum tucked away, so we bought a pup. We did all right, until she ran off with the barman. Then I started a second-hand car business, and that was how I met my present wife. I hadn't been doing too well till she come along, but my word, she made it go with a zip. Knew a lot about cars, she did. Then one day, out of the blue, she said I wasn't pulling me weight. Bought my share of the business from me and told me to get out, which I did.
Oh dear, said Mr. Crookshank.
Well, I don't think I'm really suited to building up a business of my own.
Mr. Parker looked him up and down.
Perhaps not. It's all a matter of temperament, after all. Still, you think about what I've said, old son. Give it your mature consideration. I think you've got a winner in those plaster birds of yours.
By the way, what time did you say your train was?
Oh, my goodness, I shall have to run.
Mr. Crookshank gathered up his suitcase and his briefcase and his umbrella, and then juggled with them so that he could shake hands with Parker.
Goodbye, Mr. Parker. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
The great thing to remember, Albert, old son, is that you've got to make a gesture of defiance at life every now and then. Now, don't forget, will you?
After he'd arrived at Mrs. Chapman's and had had an unaccustomed drink or two in the pub up the road, Mr. Crookshank came to a decision. At 9:30 on Monday morning, 2 weeks later, Albert Crookshank's suntanned face over a gaily spotted bow tie popped round Mr. Smalldean's office door.
Morning, Smalldean, I'm here.
So I see, Crookshank, so I see. You realise what time it is? You're 30 minutes late.
Oh, too bad, said Albert.
The telephone rang, and after picking up the receiver, Mr. Smalldean waved Albert Crookshank out of the room.
I'll talk to you later, Crookshank.
Humming cheerfully, Albert sauntered down the corridor, pausing only to greet the managing director, Mr. Bridlake, in a tone at once so pleasant and so assured that Mr. Bridlake stood looking after him in surprised approval. Miss Cardew followed him into his drab office.
Oh, Mr. Crookshank, I tried to catch you before you went into Mr. Smalldean. You know I always open his mail in the morning, and you didn't mark your letter personal, and, well, when I saw what you'd said about him picking your brains all these years, and what a fool you think he is, and how you didn't care if he sacked you because it would be worth it to say all this to him, well, I thought you must have been, well, you know, not feeling very well when you wrote it. So I took the liberty of keeping it back. I've got it locked away in my drawer. I do hope I did the right thing, but the office wouldn't be the same without you, Mr. Crookshank. I couldn't bear it if you left after all these years.
Disappointment. Then a sudden warmth that came from a realization that, after all, he was glad he wouldn't have to leave. After all these years, he didn't really want to leave at all. Didn't want to leave Miss Cardew.
No, you did quite right, he said. I'm very grateful to you.
Oh, good, I am glad. I was so worried this morning when you came in late. You've never been late in your life, Mr. Crookshank. What happened? What made you do it?
Oh, that, said Mr. Crookshank.
That was just a gesture, Miss Cardew. A small gesture of defiance. I may do it again sometime.
Tomorrow's story, written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo and told by Anthony Bilbo, is called Film Festival.
11 o'clock, and time for another morning story with Anthony Bilbo. It's called Worthington Takes a Stand.
Hello. It's been a long time since my dog Worthington and I had any serious disagreement over his chair. A long time until this time, that is. It's been a perfectly amicable agreement. He's allowed me to keep my reasonably new, reasonably clean, and quite well-proportioned armchair on one side of the fire, and I've allowed him to keep his unbelievably old, unbelievably shabby, and unbelievably hideous armchair on the other. He never sits in my chair, and I never sit in his. It takes no effort of self-denial on my part, I can tell you. Then a couple of months ago, I began to get the urge to do the room up a bit. You know how it is. The first watery beam of spring sunlight that comes through the window shows you how grubby everything has got during the winter. And even somebody as house humble as I am begins to feel a vague dissatisfaction. So I bought a new hearth rug. The old one, which was decorated with lions and things, was molting badly, largely the result of Gladstone the parrot pulling bits out of it whenever he's called round. I realised the situation was getting desperate when I caught my toe in a frayed and rampant lion and went headlong, just when I was about to sit down to enjoy a scalding hot cup of coffee. After the hearth rug came the new curtain. The old ones looked all right to me, but feeling they could do with a wash, I sent them to the laundry. Next week I got back a little note from the manageress that said, "Dear Mr. Bilbo, I regret that the dusters you sent with your laundry last week are no longer in the condition to stand up to immersion in our washing machine. Please advise and oblige." Well, I was sorry about that. We'd been through a lot together, me and those curtains. But you can see how the rot spread. The new curtains showed up the discoloured paint on the window frames. New paint on the window frames showed up all the rough marks on the walls. And new paint on the walls showed up the grubby, worn covers on my armchair and the settee. And so it went on, until there was just one glaring eyesore in the entire living room. That's right, Worthington's chair. I'm sure I've described it to you before, but so that you can picture it again in its full horror, I'll just mention that it's about 50 years old, but looks more. I suppose you could call it a wing chair. It has a high back and arms that were once padded, and now ooze bits of stuffing through holes in the covering. The springs have gone in the seat and in the back, and when Worthington stirs in his sleep, they squeak and groan an accompaniment to his snores. It can never have been handsome, even when it was young, and just starting out on a career of providing the maximum discomfort with the minimum of artistic pleasure. And in his old age, it doesn't even have the virtue of being quaint. I've never had fashionable interior decorators begging me to sell it to them. It's just Worthington's hideous old chair, and he's devoted to it. I put my mind to thinking of ways and means of breaking it to Worthington that the moment of truth had come at last, and that he would have to exchange that monstrosity for something with less character but more tone. Now, you mustn't think that Worthington hadn't noticed what was going on, and quite apart from any threat to his chair, he objects on principle to too much change and upheaval at home. Out for walks, or visiting, or on holiday, he's as adventurous and eager for new experiences as anyone. But at home, he likes everything to remain exactly the same. For instance, he sulked for days when I moved the television from one side of the room to the other, and he went on hunger strike for at least 6 hours when I threw away his cracked earthenware bowl and substituted a red plastic one. As he watched the arrival of each new piece of furniture, each pot of paint, he assumed more and more the appearance of a dog who is besieged by enemies and is expecting dragons to attack at any moment. He retreated to the chair as if it were an island fortress and spent most of his time huddled in it, staring at me reproachfully and twitching his nose and sneezing at the smell of paint. He rather spoiled the effect, however, by keeping up this act long after the smell had gone. I talked the problem over with various friends, and the majority opinion was that I shouldn't let my life be ruled by a dog, and it was high time I showed Worthington who was boss. "Well, true enough," I said, "but how do I do that?" Nobody knew. I decided on compromise. Worthington's chair should at least have a new cover, one that I could take along to the laundrette and wash from time to time. If he didn't mind that too much, he might come round to the idea of a new chair. I called in on the shop in the High Street where they advertise that they make loose covers, and was told that there Mr. Simpkins would call round to measure up. Mr. Simpkins looked less than happy when faced with a large, unfriendly-looking chair occupied by a large, disgruntled-looking dog. All right, off you get, Worthington, I said. He didn't move, of course. And so I went behind the chair and tipped it over slowly so that eventually the sheer force of gravity made him slither out onto the floor. There you are, Mr. Simpkins, I said. It's all yours. Mr. Simpkins was a very stout man with glasses, and he wore a dark worsted suit that had pins sticking out of it all over the sleeves and lapels. He carried a tape measure and a black notebook. He looked more closely at Worthington's chair and was visibly shaken. You're quite sure you want a cover made for this article of furniture? Yes, Mr. Simpkins, I am. Put it this way, Mr. B. You wouldn't put a Paris model on a woman that didn't have a good figure, would you? I said I wasn't asking for a Paris model gown. All I wanted was a simple, hard-wearing cover for this chair, for my dog, to sit on. He nodded sadly. Then he bent very slowly at the knees until his face was on a level with one of the arms of the chair. Worthington's nose and accusing eyes appeared like a jack-in-the-box on the other side, and they stared at each other.
Good doggy. A nice doggy, said Mr. Simpkins.
Worthington said nothing, but raised his top lip in a sort of sneer. Mr. Simpkins took out a handkerchief and wiped his forehead.
Very strong teeth he's got, Mr. B. Is he likely to...
No, he isn't, I said. This act is for my benefit, not yours. But if he's embarrassing you, I'll take him away. That, of course, was easier said than done. Worthington had no intention of going out into the kitchen just because I wanted him to. I tried pushing, but for all the progress I made, he might have been one of the lions in Trafalgar Square, made of the same material. I tried to lift him, but as he'd made himself a dead, limp weight on floor level, I couldn't get the necessary purchase. It was Mr. Simpkins who noticed and slyly drew my attention to the fact that Worthington was sitting on the hearth rug. So we both took hold of one end of the rug and tobogganed Worthington across the floor into the kitchen before he knew what was happening. Sorry, Worthington, this hurts me more than it hurts you, I said, but you'll thank me for it later. He turned his back on me. I shut the kitchen door and left him alone with his umbrage. Mr. Simpkins was already writing in his little notebook when I returned to the living room. I thought he was taking measurements, but I've since learned that he was making a note for inclusion in a speech he was giving next week at the annual dinner of the Guild of Worshipful Upholsterers. Apparently, his funny story about the man whose dog bossed him about was a riot, and he's always being asked for an encore. It was 3 weeks before Mr. Simpkins returned with the loose cover. 3 weeks that Worthington and I spent peacefully and on our usual amiable terms. I felt a bit deceitful, to tell you the truth. He obviously thought I'd given up. You see, he doesn't appreciate how long some things take. Luckily, I managed to open the door to Mr. Simpkins by myself. Normally, Worthington comes too, because he's nosy. But I happened to be looking out of the window when Mr. Simpkins' van turned the corner into our street. I pulled open the door just as Mr. Simpkins was putting out his hand to ring the bell.
Oh, Mr. Bilbo, there's a coincidence. I've just brought round your chair cover. Very nice of you, Mr. Simpkins, but I wonder if you'd mind lowering your voice. I don't want Worthington to know just yet.
Don't want Worthington to what? Oh, I see, the dog. But I don't see how you can keep it a secret. Once I've fitted it on, he's bound to see it. Oh, I'm sure it fits perfectly, I said. I'll put it on when I think the moment's right.
No, really, I assure you, Mr. Simpkins, I'd much rather. I'm quite sure you've done a good job of it. Mr. Simpkins handed the parcel over with reluctance, making me promise to ring him up immediately if I had any trouble. I knew I was in for trouble all right, but not the sort he meant. I hid the parcel in the bottom of my wardrobe and sat down on the edge of my bed to think. I preferred not to do my thinking in the same room as Worthington, because I believe he picks up thought waves of some kind. Otherwise, how does he seem to know what I'm going to do, even before I know myself? And then I had what I still think was a brainwave. I telephoned half a dozen friends and asked them round for coffee that evening, and told them all to bring anyone they liked. I bustled back into the living room, giving a masterly impression of someone who's just heard that unexpected guests are on their way. "Visitors coming, Worthington," I said. He pricked up his ears and looked interested. Yes, lots of visitors. Come on, let's get ready." I rushed backwards and forwards, moving ashtrays and things, and putting all the newspapers and books into heaps instead of leaving them scattered over everything. The object of this was to convince him that some really special do was on that evening. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw that Worthington was picking up this feeling of excitement. And after a bit, he got down from his chair, walked out into the kitchen, and came back carrying his rubber ring, which he laid with precision in the center of the coffee table. "Oh, yes, very nice," I said. "Oh, yes, sets the place off a treat. Just what it needed." He wagged his tail. The moment had come. Or if it hadn't, it never would. I hurried into the bedroom, brought out the cover, and had his chair dressed in it while he was still figuring out what I was up to. "Just while our visitors are here," I said. "Just the finishing touch, you know." The doorbell rang. I left Worthington stunned, staring at his chair in a sort of coma. As I let my visitors in, I whispered to each of them to make a particular point of noticing Worthington's chair and to remark on it favourably. Well, I suppose we overdid it a bit. But you can never tell with dogs. Sometimes they act as though flattery and soft soap don't mean a thing. At other times they lap it up and beg for more. I think Worthington was reasonably taken in to begin with. After all, the first comers were able to see the room as a whole, and those who hadn't been to see us recently could quite genuinely comment on the improvements I'd made to it. And from that, it was a simple step to remark on the extremely handsome cover on Worthington's chair. The warm tones of their voices and their admiring glances put over the message, and he looked quite pleased, conceited even. And then Bob Granger, who always knows when to pick the exquisitely wrong moment, did it again. "Come on, Worthington," he said, in the middle of a 5-second lull in the conversation. "Come on, let's see what you look like in it, after all the fuss you've made." Everybody froze and waited. Worthington walked twice round the chair, sneering at it. Then he stalked over to the open door and turned to face us. With half a second's pause between each one, he sneezed 3 times. Then he barked once, turned slowly, and disappeared down the passage. No question of it, we'd overdone it badly. Half an hour later, everybody had gone. I mean, what was the point? Even Bob Granger could see that. The door closed on the last guest, and I set about looking for Worthington. But he wasn't in the kitchen, or the bedroom, or the cupboard under the stairs. I walked slowly back into the living room. And there was Worthington. "Oi," I said. He was sitting in my chair, bolt upright in my chair, staring into the middle distance. And there the matter rests for the present. I think psychiatrists call it transference of affection, but with Worthington it's plain-cuttedness. And if you think that the answer is to take the cover off the old chair and let him have it back, I've tried it. He turns his nose up in overacted distaste. I wonder if Mr. Simpkins would accept it as a gift. He's to make a good illustration for his next after-dinner speech at the Guild of Worshipful Upholsterers. Well, that's the end of this week of stories, and I hope to be with you again before long. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Worthington Takes a Stand, told by Anthony Bilbo, was written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo.
It's 11 o'clock, and here is Anthony Bilbo.
Good morning. It's nice to be back again. I hope you'll join me at this time every morning this week. Today, I want to tell you about the time my dog Worthington found an unusual interest. If it hadn't rained all that holiday, it would never have happened. I suppose bad weather is blamed for a lot of things, from tonsillitis to twins, and not always fairly. But in this case, there's no doubt about it. Worthington and I were both feeling rather tired and depressed after a long, dreary winter with too little fresh air and too many late nights. And I thought it would do us both a power of good to get away to some quiet seaside resort for a week, with sea breezes to blow away the cobwebs around our brains, and long, healthy tramps along the sands and over the cliffs to set our blood tingling. 10 minutes after Worthington and I arrived at... Well, no, perhaps I'd better not mention the name of the place, as I might get the cinema manager into trouble, and he only did it out of kindness. Anyway, 10 minutes after we arrived, it began to rain. It went on raining. To begin with, we took it in our stride. Or rather, I took it in my stride. I was determined that no drop of rain was going to spoil my holiday. So I put on a Mac and called to Worthington to come for a good long walk. I should have remembered, of course, that he hates getting his fur wet. You see, it's so long and thick that at first the rain doesn't penetrate. But after about half an hour, he gets waterlogged, and his coat lies flat along his backbone and hangs, dripping and muddy, from his chest and legs. It's just about then that he starts registering his disapproval by lagging a carefully judged 50 yards behind me, and nothing I can do or say will persuade him to catch up. As usual, it had the result he intended. I soon got fed up with turning my head and calling, "Oh, come on, Worthington!" So I gave in and took him back to the hotel, where I had to spend a good 3/4 of an hour rubbing him down with old newspapers and washing and drying his muddy feet. He endured all this with a look on his face that said, "This is all your own fault," just about as clearly as if he'd been able to put it into words. If anything, it was even more infuriating. It rained all that night, and the next day, when we woke up, it was still raining. We spent the morning huddled in a chilly hotel lounge. I read all the morning papers and a few out-of-date magazines, and Worthington sprawled on the floor and had to endure being stepped over and walked round. He put up with it pretty well until someone came into the lounge with a very small dog that started to yap the moment it caught sight of Worthington. It wasn't Worthington's fault. He tried to take no notice, but being so much the bigger, people thought he'd started it all. And in any case, he couldn't sleep with all that row going on. So, after lunch, we set off for the seafront in the hopes of finding some sort of amusement that was under cover. As it was early in the season, hardly anything was properly open. We did find an amusement arcade with pin tables and those toy cranes where you try to win a gold watch and end up with a couple of brightly coloured sweets. I gave the sweets to Worthington, but he spat them out. You couldn't say we were having a hilarious time. Then I came across a fortune-telling machine, one of those where you press a button under your particular sign of the zodiac. You know the sort. I put sixpence in for myself, and the card that came out said, "Take great care today, as your impetuous nature will lead you into danger," which wasn't awfully encouraging. So I put another sixpence in for Worthington, and that said, "Don't put too much trust in your friends." Well, after that, I decided it was time we went for a cup of tea. We lingered in the warmth of the cafe for as long as we decently could, and then made our way further into the town, away from the seafront, hugging the edge of the pavement nearest to the wall. We hadn't gone more than 100 yards when there was a tremendous peal of thunder, and the rain began to come down in bucketsful. We dashed for the nearest doorway and found ourselves by the pay box of the one and only cinema. I knew it was the only one because its name was quite simply the cinema. Or it might have been the kinema, I can't remember now. The manager sauntered up beside me with a careful nonchalance. Nasty day, he said. Horrible, I agreed. I arrived yesterday and it's been raining all the time. Oh, too bad, too bad. Why don't you come inside and see the show, sir? It's nice and dry and warm inside, and when you come out, why, the sun may be shining and you can have a nice stroll along the front. I only wish I could, I said, but I can't very well because I've got my dog with me. And I indicated the dejected figure of Worthington as he sat by the pay desk, staring out at the wet roadway. The cinema manager pinched his bottom lip between finger and thumb and looked thoughtful. It does make it a bit difficult for you. Is he a quiet dog? Well behaved and all that? Probably a lot better behaved than some of the people you get in your audiences, I said, feeling a little indignant on Worthington's behalf. Oh, no doubt, no doubt, no doubt. It's all about that. I can see that by looking at him. The cinema manager sensed my annoyance. What I really meant to say was, if you're sure he wouldn't wander about the place or bark or do anything else to make people notice him, I don't see why you shouldn't take him in with you just this once. I'll see you get a seat at the back. We didn't need to be asked twice. I bought a packet of cigarettes for me and a bag of salted peanuts for Worthington, and in we went. A few whispered words from the manager to the usherette, and we were taken to an empty row. Actually, there were quite a number of empty rows. I sat in an end seat, and Worthington lay down underneath. It was a very old film, and it had never been a good film, even in its heyday, which was probably the early 30s. In the normal way, I'd have run a mile rather than see it, but it was such a relief to be dry and warm that I didn't care. I bent down to offer Worthington a handful of peanuts, but found to my alarm that he wasn't there. Instead, he'd wriggled out from underneath and was now sitting in the aisle beside me, bolt upright, with his eyes glued to the screen and his ears turned towards the sound that came from it. He'd never been to the pictures before, of course. I can only imagine that he found the experience tremendously exciting. And as it was his first visit, you couldn't have expected him to be very critical. He was so wrapped up in what was going on the screen that he forgot about his peanuts, so I ate them all myself and had to buy him another packet when we left to make it up to him. I can see myself now, watching Worthington far more than the film, and smiling to myself and thinking what an amusing story this was going to be when I got home. Little did I know. Well, it rained all the rest of that week, and there really was nothing else for it. We went to the pictures every night. We did get a change of program on the Thursday, but by the time we left to come home, I could have recited the dialogue of those wretched films practically word for word. I fell asleep more than once, but Worthington's attention never flagged for a second. Looking back now, I know I should have realized what was coming, but isn't it strange how the most obvious things sometimes get missed? The first evening of our return home, I decided to go out for dinner, as I hadn't anything to eat in the flat but one tin of pilchards and half a bottle of lime juice. On our way to the restaurant, we had to pass one of our local cinemas, a simply enormous place, all chandeliers and black marble and carpet 6 inches thick. Before I realized what was happening, Worthington had bounded up the steps, strolled through the vestibule, and sat in happy anticipation by the pay desk. I called to him, but he wouldn't come, so I had to follow him in. The commissioner looked down his nose at Worthington, and then at me, and said, "Is that your dog, sir?" Yes, I said. I rather think he wants to come in and see the show. I'll admit I did have a faint hope that he'd say we could come in sometimes when things were quiet, but he just laughed in a slightly sneering way, as though I'd made a very poor joke, and said, "No dogs allowed in here." Worthington heard what the commissioner said, but he didn't budge, and I had to get behind him and shove before he'd move. And you see, it didn't end there. Every time we passed the cinema, and there are several near us, Worthington went up to the pay desk and sat waiting for me to book our seats. Then when I went up to him to get him to come away, people waiting to go in thought I was trying to jump the queue and started calling me names. It got to be very embarrassing. And apart from all that, I felt so terribly sorry for Worthington. He was so obviously suffering all the pangs of Paradise Lost. When a day came that a film was on that I myself wanted to see, I found I couldn't leave him at home and go to see it by myself without feeling that I was letting him down badly. I wrestled with my conscience, and my conscience lost. So I showed Worthington where to wait, and then I bought a ticket for myself, and when the lights were down, I went and let him in by one of the emergency exits. Nobody noticed him, and it was a very good film. During the next few weeks, we did this quite often. On several occasions, I thought we'd been spotted, but nobody said anything. Perhaps they thought they were seeing things and were afraid of being laughed at. But the strain was beginning to tell on me. For one thing, I could never sit through to the end of the film. Before the hero took the heroine into his arms for the last kiss, or the detective made his arrest, or the government troops arrived in the nick of time to save the hero from the Indians, Worthington and I had to leave under cover of darkness by the nearest side door. And I used to wake up at night and lie there, wondering what would happen if we were caught by the manager. You see, Worthington didn't have a ticket, of course, and I've no idea how much you can be fined for not paying for your dog's seat. Well, not his seat, but at least his presence in the cinema. After all, you pay to see the film, not necessarily to have a seat. Otherwise, you could stand at the back for nothing, couldn't you? We might go to prison, get our names in the paper. Just think of the disgrace. I really don't think I could have stood it much longer if release from my predicament hadn't come quite unexpectedly. My sister Marjorie and her husband Bill bought themselves a second-hand cine camera, and after they'd taken a few films, they asked Worthington and me round to see the show. Worthington enjoyed it quite well. He was getting more critical by now, but at least it made a change for him not having to sit under the seat. All the same, I don't think it would have taken the place of a real, super-colossal, widescreen, stereophonic production in his heart if it hadn't been for the fact that Marjorie and Bill thought they'd like to take a film in which he would have a part. He had quite a minor role in the first one. It was just a routine thing, showing a few friends having tea in the garden, laughing, talking, that sort of thing. With Worthington sitting on the grass and occasionally moving round the table to have a word with different ones. When he saw himself on the screen, he was delighted and kept pushing a cold, wet nose against Marjorie's arm until she showed the film all over again. "This is marvellous," I said. "Now I shall be able to go to the cinema in peace, and whenever the craving comes over Worthington, I'll bring him round here, and you can show him his film." "Oh, I think you'll soon get bored with the same old film over and over again," Marjorie objected. "Let's work out a few good meaty plots where he can take a leading part. What about that one-act play you did with him once for our Amateur Dramatic Society? Surely we could condense the action of that into a few good, exciting incidents." Well, it did seem a bright idea. The play she had in mind was one in which I played a Russian peasant and Worthington was a savage wolf. He'd certainly brought the house down when he'd done it on the stage, and I must confess that I'd rather fancied my own performance, so I was only too glad to do as Marjorie suggested, and the very next Sunday saw Worthington and me doing our nuts in the back garden, with all the neighbours pretending not to look. The finished job wasn't bad at all. Technically speaking, I suppose it was full of faults, But everyone that saw it enjoyed it immensely. For the first two or three times, that is. For now, I found that I'd jumped out of the frying pan into the fire, and I'd pulled Marjorie and Bill in with me. Worthington wants to make a new film every week. If not, he wants to go to the local cinema instead. And I find that since I've stopped taking him illegally, I've lost my nerve and can't start doing it again. So, a new film every week it has to be, followed by a full showing of all the previous ones. And really, it's getting so monotonous. We're running out of plots. After all, there aren't all that many things a dog can do in a film, are there? Have you seen any good plots lately?
That story, Worthington Goes to the Pictures, was told by Anthony Bilbo. He'll be back at the same time tomorrow with a story called Dear Miss Jenkins. It's 11 o'clock, and here is Anthony Bilbo.
Hello again. The events I'm going to tell you about this morning happened soon after I got my first job. George Gray sat on the corner of my desk and called to the girl with the tea to bring his cup to him there. Not busy, are you, Bilbo? He said. Well, I have got rather a lot to catch up on. Oh, dear me. Quite the busy young executive this morning, aren't we? Said George. He made me feel pompous and embarrassed, though all I'd been trying to do was forestall one of his spiteful bits of gossip. I gave in and offered him a cigarette. He lit up, took a long draw at it, and then leaned forward confidentially. Have you heard the latest about old Frosty Face? He said. Oh, Lord, I thought he's on about Miss Jenkins again. About 5 years ago, when I first started working for Inglesby & Co., I was new to the business world and wasn't enjoying it very much. So to begin with, I took people very much at their face values. That meant I liked the people who smiled at me and disliked those who didn't. George Gray was one of those I liked at first because he talked to me at once. He chattered about his love life, the number of gins he'd managed to sink at the last party he'd been to, and he talked about people in the office. I didn't find it very interesting, but I was glad to have anyone notice me as I sat, very humble and nervous, at the shabbiest desk in the darkest corner of the smallest office. On the other hand, one of the people I didn't like very much to begin with was Miss Jenkins, the boss's secretary. She was slim, coolly attractive, neatly dressed in a grey suit, and some years older than myself. Her air of quiet efficiency and her position as the keeper of the confidential files in which were recorded the boss's opinions on his staff made her an object of my deepest awe. And the only words she ever addressed to me, other than good morning and good evening, were those fateful ones. Mr. Bilbo, Mr. Inglesby would like to see you in his office. However, as I got more into the way of things, time didn't hang so heavily on my hands, and George Gray's long chats became rather a nuisance. I also found his hail fellow well-met chattiness masked an insatiable and vindictive curiosity about everyone concerned with the office. He was a male gossip, and anyone who's had any dealings with a male gossip knows the breed to be far more cruel than the female variety. His appearance of imparting a secret to you alone had led more than one lonely soul to confide in him, only to find within a couple of weeks that the tale had gone right round the building, suitably embellished with enough inaccuracies to make the victim feel even more embarrassed, and yet not altered enough for the story to be denied. Here he was, at it again, with Miss Jenkins as his target this time. George flicked ash all over the papers in my in tray and chuckled. Seems she was jilted. Back near the end of the war it was, and since then she's hated men. And that's why she's such a soured old spinster, old boy. I nearly burst out laughing. I'd a pretty good idea that George had made several passes at Miss Jenkins in the 18 months he'd been with the firm, and that it was the grape that was sour. All the same, I happen to know that he got very near the truth. And as it was Amy Jenkins herself who told me about it, I was troubled that she might think it was I who'd passed it on to George. It was quite by chance that she and I got friendly. A rush job had come up, which had meant we'd both had to work late several nights in a row. And the comradeship that comes when people work long, tiring hours together had broken down both my awe of her and her unapproachableness, which in any case I found to be only a facade, hiding a shy and sensitive nature. It was an ordinary enough story, I suppose. The only thing that made it different was the effect it had on her. It seemed she'd left school during the war and had gone straight into one of the women's forces, the WAF, I think it was. She hadn't been unhappy exactly, but her retiring nature made it difficult for her to make friends, and she'd gone through her days in uniform like someone in a dream. "It's a curious thing," she said, "but I can hardly remember a single thing that happened. I just got up in the morning, folded my blankets, swept and polished my bedspace, had breakfast, and then went along to my typing job in the squadron office. I must have done other things. I know I went to the camp cinema sometimes with other girls in my hut, and a few times to dances in the Natty. But it all seems to merge into one vague pattern with nothing standing out as worth remembering. Until the day I met Jim." Her eyes seemed to light up as she said the name, and her cheeks grew pink. If George could have seen Amy Jenkins then, he wouldn't have dared call her a soured old spinster. "I met Jim when I was waiting for a bus. He was a Canadian soldier. He asked me when the next bus would be along, and he was so bright and talkative that I couldn't feel shy with him. Before we got back to camp, he'd already asked me for a date, and I'd agreed. After that, we spent every free moment together. We even used to meet for nappy breaks, when he could get away. He asked me to marry him. Then D-Day came, and he went away. And I never heard from him again. He could have been killed, of course, or badly injured. I wasn't his next of kin. And as he'd been on some special detachment from his regiment, I hadn't met any of his friends who might have written to tell me what happened. I waited and waited. I suppose I never really stopped waiting." Amy Jenkins blinked once or twice, and I pretended to be taking extra care spreading the butter on my toast until she went on with her story. Don't think I've never had any men friends since then. I have. And some of them wanted to marry me. There was one in particular. I'm sure I'd have been very happy married to him, but somehow I felt it wouldn't be right to marry, knowing my feelings for Jim were just as strong as ever. So I said no. People of the office seem to think I'm cold and unfeeling. I know George Gray does. But I made a vow when I joined Inglesby & Co. that I wouldn't let any of the men get fond of me. And so I suppose I must seem a bit standoffish. There didn't seem a lot I could say to Amy Jenkins. If I'd been an older man, or even as old as I am now, I might have been able to think of the right words. But all I managed then was a halting expression of sympathy and a hope that maybe she'd hear something from Jim one day. "That's what I believe." Her eyes shone with a light that was almost fanatical. "I believe one day I'll be walking down the street, or even waiting at the bus stop again, and he'll come up to me just as he did all those years ago. That's why I came to London to work. Nearly everyone comes to London sometime or other." Well, as everybody knows, miracles do sometimes happen. And 3 months, almost to the day after Amy Jenkins told me her story, she rang me up on the internal telephone and asked me if I'd go into her office and have a word with her in private. When I got there, she was passing a lot of files and papers over to her assistant. And though she was as efficient as ever, there was an occasional break in her instructions when it seemed as though she'd forgotten what she was about to say. And then she picked up the thread again and carried on. When her assistant had left the room, Amy turned to me and caught hold of both my hands. "Tony, it's happened. It actually happened. I've met Jim again, just as I always thought I would. I was walking down Regent Street, and we bumped into each other. Literally. He'd lost his memory."
but he's got it back again, and he was in this country wondering how to find me. I've asked Mr. Inglesby for the week off. I'm going right now, right this minute, but I just had to let you know before I left. And she flung on her hat, picked up her bag, and danced out of the office and down the corridor. George Gray came out of a door further down and caught sight of her disappearing round the corner.
"What's up with old Frosty? Had words with the boss at last," he said.
"Oh, she's just off for a week's holiday. Something came up rather unexpectedly," I said. I wasn't going to give George anything he could chew over. I didn't see Amy when she came back from her week's holiday because old Mr. Inglesby decided it was time I spent a fortnight or so with the firm's branch in Manchester. I had a card from George Gray with a P.S. that read, "Fancy old Frosty Face's boyfriend turning up after all these years," which showed me that, as usual, George wasn't far behind in picking up all the gossip. Though goodness only knows how he did it. I got back to London at about midday on a Friday 3 weeks later, and decided it would show keenness if I reported to the office in the afternoon. The first person I saw was George Gray. He was sitting in my chair, with his feet up on my desk, drinking what was, in a sense, my coffee. "Oh, hello, old man," he said. "Didn't expect you back until after the weekend. Don't mind if I sit here for a bit, do you?" "No, not at all," I said. "Anyway, I've only dropped in to see if there's anything special Mr. Inglesby wants to know about my trip. I'm just going round to Miss Jenkins to ask whether he's free."
"Oh, do, by all means, old boy," said George. "But you won't find old Jenky there. She's gone off home. Rushed in here after lunch, white as a sheet, looking as though she'd been crying. Joan, that's the girl who does her work when she's away, Joan told me, in the strictest confidence, of course, that she thinks her boyfriend turned out to be married or something."
I could tell now where George had been getting his information, but I was too perturbed to take any special notice.
"Married," I said.
You mean he married someone while he'd lost his memory?" George gave a loud, jeering laugh.
"Lost his memory, my foot," he said. "He never lost his memory any more than I have. No, he was married all along. That's what Joan says. Married even when he picked her up first."
George put his coffee cup down and sauntered towards the door.
"Might be a chance for you now, old man. You seem to have taken quite a fancy to her. Bit old for you, of course, but I bet she has a tidy bit of money put aside.
Still, I should hurry up. You never know what she might do to herself after a letdown like this." Amy Jenkins had a tiny, self-contained flatlet nearly at the top of a big square block. The lift was stuck somewhere, and I didn't wait but ran up the stairs, round and round, only pausing to identify the floors, until, hot and panting, I reached the fifth. I hadn't quite got my breath back when I rang the bell outside her door, and when she opened it to me, I couldn't do more than gasp out, "Oh, hello, Amy." I didn't know what else to say, anyway. She didn't look very surprised to see me, but led me through into the tiny sitting room where my eyes were immediately drawn to a pile of blackened paper ash in the hearth. Amy nodded. "Yes, they're the letters Jim wrote to me when he was on guard duty and couldn't meet me. There were only five of them, and I've kept them all these years. I'm sure the story's all round the office. That's why you've come, so I can make it brief. Today, when we were having lunch, his wife came into the restaurant, and she came over and sat with us. She's a very nice woman. Didn't say anything to make things worse for me than they were, but there it was." She fell silent and stood looking down at the little heap of ashes. Was he married all the time, even when you met him during the war?" I asked.
I don't know. I didn't ask. You see, when I found Jim again, I thought I was going to feel just as I did before. But I didn't. He was just the same, just as bright and jolly and talkative, but I found something was missing. Maybe it was never there. Or perhaps it's just that I was young and inexperienced. I don't know. But now, Tony, he was so boring. I didn't know what to do. I almost panicked. I didn't see any way in which I could decently get out of marrying him. Not after he'd come back to me from the other side of the world. And then his wife turned up, and I found the whole story of his having lost his memory was all a lie. He's over here on business. Meeting me was just an accident that he took advantage of. The shock was terrible at first. I felt quite sick. But when I got back here and had time to sit down and think, I began to wonder why I wasn't more upset. And then it hit me. I was overwhelmed with relief. I'm free, completely free. I can marry if I want to. I can stay single if I want to. The important thing is that at last I've laid the ghost of my wartime love affair. I'm really very grateful to Jim and his wife for coming back into my life. I haven't seen Amy Jenkins for some years. Soon after the events I've told you about, she left Inglesby & Co. and took a job abroad. I don't even know whether she's married by now or not. But I am sure that no one calls her Old Frosty Face anymore.
That story, Dear Miss Jenkins, was told by Anthony Bilbo. He'll be back at the same time tomorrow with a story called Gladstone's Rescue.
Now, this week's morning stories are told by Anthony Bilbo, and here he is with the first one called Gladstone's Happy Event.
Hello again. It's nice to be back, and I hope you'll join me every morning this week. Tap, tap, tap. There was no mistaking that determined rapping on the pane of my living room window. It was Gladstone the parrot, dropping in for a spot of free bed and board. I looked across at my dog Worthington, who was stretched out on the hearthrug, and raised my eyebrows at him. He looked back at me and yawned. We were both too comfortable to move. The rapping came again, louder, with a sort of irritable impatience about it. Our friend Glynn, who was sprawled on the settee with his feet on a cushion and an open tin of salted peanuts resting on his stomach, turned his head and said, "I say, Boyle, I don't know whether I'm hearing things, but wasn't that some kind of banging out the window?" Yes, I said, it was. "Well then, why don't you see what it is?" And he tossed a peanut across to Worthington, who fielded it with a neat snap of his jaws. "Don't have to," I said. "I know what it is. Any more nuts?" "Oh, sorry, they've all gone. All this early rising has given me the most enormous appetite. Always seem to be eating these days. Shocking, isn't it?" Glynn, I should mention, got married 6 months ago to a girl back home who owns a farm. At least her father owns the farm, but she's the only child. And she and Glynn are learning how to manage it. He came up to London for one of those farming exhibitions and asked if he could spend the night on my settee, which was how he came to be there on this particular Saturday evening. Gladstone rapped on the window again. So loudly this time, I was afraid he'd shatter the glass with his beak. I dragged myself to my feet, went over to the window, and opened it.
"Avast, me hearty, show a leg there."
Gladstone bounced through and landed on Glynn's stomach, right beside the empty peanut tin. He cocked his head and peered into it.
"Any more nuts, matey?"
"They've all gone, Gladstone," I said. "You've chosen a bad day. Glynn's eaten all the nuts and drunk all your spare rum, so you'll have to take potluck until Monday. That is, if you're staying that long."
"Ah, poor Gladstone, poor, poor Gladstone," said the selfish old bird.
He balanced thoughtfully on his left leg and scratched his beak with the other. Or maybe he was scratching his leg with his beak, but whatever it was he was doing, it somehow gave him an air of one who meditates.
"Hello, Boyle," said Glynn. "Good Boyle."
Gladstone put down his right leg and looked at Glynn. Until then, I don't think he knew he was standing on someone. Now he began to waddle up and down, tugging at Glynn's jacket buttons and pushing his head into Glynn's pockets in search of food. Needless to say, he didn't find any. So he turns his attention to me again. When he found I meant what I said, and all the rum and peanuts were gone, he fluttered on top of the television, and for 20 seconds the air was bright blue. Glynn gazed at him admiringly. "What a vocabulary," he said. "My father worked in Cardiff Docks once, and I used to think his language was pretty colourful, but this beats him entirely." "Yes, well, Gladstone used to be at sea at one time," I said, "and he's knocked around quite a bit since then. Nobody knows how old he is, but he's certainly old in wickedness." I went on to explain how my Uncle Willoughby won him from a gambler in South America and brought him back here and gave him to me, but that nobody really owns Gladstone. He just goes round spending a few days at a time wherever he fancies to. "Oh, sounds a wonderful life," said Glynn. "A proper bachelor gay, as the old song says, eh? No family ties, eh, Boyle?" He stretched out a finger to scratch Gladstone's head, and to my surprise, the parrot didn't make a move to bite him, but just stood there looking at him with his bright, beady eyes. I offered Gladstone the crumbs left at the bottom of a packet of biscuits and some tea. He grumbled a bit, but he ate it. When the rest of us settled down to watch the late-night television show, Gladstone wandered round the room, peering into corners and pulling threads in the carpet, muttering to himself. After a bit, he came over and perched himself beside Worthington, absent-mindedly pulling out tufts of fur until he had a little pile beside him which he raked together into a ball. "Now watch it, Gladstone," I said. "Leave Worthington some fur. It's bad enough when he molts without you making it worse."
"Ah, miserable old vinegar drinker. Get your hair cut." "Oh, smashing bird that," said Glynn. "Don't you think we ought to go out and try and buy some rum for him?"
"No, he must wait until Monday," I said. "People are always being taken in by Gladstone. They meet him once, and they think he's a lovable old rascal. Only Worthington and I know there's nothing lovable about him at all." But as Glynn was going to have to share the living room with Gladstone overnight, it was best that they should think well of each other, so I didn't disillusion him. Next morning, Glynn was away early. He shook my hand, he shook Worthington's paw, he scratched Gladstone's head. "Well, so long, all of you," he said. He was halfway down the path when he stopped, turned, and said, "Oh, by the way, Tony." "Yes, what is it?"
"I think you'd better keep an eye on Gladstone. He's been acting funny all night."
"Oh, he always acts funny," I said.
"No, what I mean is, you see, well, if he was one of my hens, I'd say he was going broody, see?"
And Glynn bounced off down the road to catch the train home to Wales. Then I tripped over Worthington, who'd stopped dead at the sight of Gladstone standing on the coffee table, carefully shredding one of the posh Sunday papers into minute bits. I opened my mouth to shout at him to leave it alone because I hadn't read it yet, and then, on second thoughts, I shut it again. I beckoned to Worthington, and we both backed out of the room and into the kitchen to have a think. By the time I'd made a cup of coffee for me and a bowl of cocoa for Worthington, common sense had returned. Glynn, I decided, had a typically vivid Welsh imagination, and Gladstone was having a typically destructive fit of bad temper because I hadn't got any of his favourite rum in the flat. I told Worthington to drink up, drained my own coffee, and returned to the living room with a light heart. Gladstone was nowhere to be seen. My eyes went at first to the windows, but they were both shut, so I knew he hadn't flown away. I moved over to the fireplace and was just about to peer up the chimney when Worthington gave a bark. I turned and found him gazing at the waste paper basket. Well, it isn't really a waste paper basket, it's more of a metal bin, so you can't see into it through the sides, only from above. And there, huddled down in a sort of heap, sat Gladstone, looking, well, looking broody. "Are you feeling all right, Gladstone?" I said.
"Oh, matey, Gladstone's poorly.
Poor old thing, I thought. Maybe he needs a tonic. So I said, look, Gladstone, I know of an off-license that might be open. How would it be if I went out and got you a tot of rum and a tin of peanuts?
Ah, that's what the doctor ordered, matey.
I left Worthington to keep an eye on Gladstone and hurried to the off-license. When I got back, Gladstone was still sitting in the same place in the waste paper bin, and Worthington was still watching him. I poured a drop of rum into a saucer. Gladstone lifted his head and looked interested, and as I placed the saucer on the table, he scrambled out of the bin and fluttered over to it.
Ah, that's a drop of the right stuff, matey, he said. Ah, good old matey.
Then I heard Worthington give an excited whine. I joined him by the waste paper bin, and there, nestling among tiny bits of paper and dollops of Worthington's fur, was an egg.
An egg?
Large, off-white, and faintly shining. Gladstone, what have you done? I said.
Arr, give us a nut, matey.
Ignoring him, I continued to gaze at the egg. Worthington, do you realise what this means? I said. We've been wrong about Gladstone all these years. She's not a he. He ought to have another name. Gladys, perhaps? Gladstone muttered something unrepeatable. No, perhaps not. What's in a name, after all? Anyway, I think we ought to put this egg somewhere safe. I started to put my hand into the bin.
Arr, take your thieving hands off.
Oh, sorry, Gladstone. I didn't mean any harm, I said. If you want to keep the bin as your nest, you're more than welcome. I just wanted to be helpful. I must say that Gladstone didn't make a particularly good mother. Although he wouldn't let Worthington or me touch the egg and screamed his head off if we went too near, he soon got bored with the business of sitting on it. As foster parents, Worthington and I were much more concerned, making sure that the room was kept warm and there weren't any drafts. To be honest, it was only after I'd given Gladstone a good strong tot of rum that he would even make an effort of his own to sit on the egg. And then he was always swearing and saying how uncomfortable he was. Now look, Gladstone, I said, if you're going to be a mother, it's high time you reformed. Agreed, Worthington? He thumped his tail. Now, repeat after me. Rock-a-bye baby on a treetop.
Rock-a-bye baby, you silly old basket.
Gladstone, this simply will not do. Don't you want your child to grow up to be a better parrot than yourself?
Arr.
Well then, make an effort. Set a good example.
Any more nuts, matey?
Well, it was obviously a waste of time trying to look after Gladstone's moral welfare, and so Worthington and I concentrated on his material well-being, arguing that a healthy parent would mean a healthy offspring, and that it would be up to us to see that his chicken learned good manners. I bought a large bottle of rum, several tins of assorted nuts from a very expensive delicatessen, and four rubber hot water bottles, which I arranged round the waste paper bin every night. It was as much as I could do to persuade Worthington to go out for his usual walk each day. The rest of the time he spent lying on the hearth rug with his nose pressed to the bin, or sitting bolt upright gazing down at the egg. I rang Mr. McSporran, Worthington's vet, to ask him what I ought to do to ensure that Gladstone's happy event passed off smoothly. But I was told that McSporran was on holiday in the Orkneys and was not expected back for another week. His locum, a Mr. Pringle, was out looking after the sick Alsatian, and his receptionist, although she tried to be helpful, knew little more about parrots and their young than I did. On the whole, she thought, I was doing all the right things, and yes, it was certainly a good idea to keep the mother well fed and indulged in all her little fancies. Gladstone was perched on my shoulder when I had this conversation. I don't know how much he heard, or, having heard, how much he understood, but he became more and more demanding. Only the freshest and juiciest of nuts would satisfy him now, and any attempts on my part to give him watered-down rum were met with strings of his ripest curses. It was only the knowledge that this situation couldn't go on forever that made life bearable.
Surely, any day now, we'd be hearing the pattering of tiny claws. But how long did Parrot's eggs take to hatch? Now, who did I know, other than Mr. McSpollen, who would be likely to be able to tell me? Glynn, of course, or Glynn's wife, Blodwyn. As a farmer's daughter, she ought to know something about birds, surely, I thought. So I picked up my telephone. Look, Blodwyn, I said, I wanted to ask you something. It may sound a bit strange, but you keep hens, don't you? Yes, I do. Oh, and that reminds me, Tony, before I forget, has your friend finished with our persuader? Your what, is it? Our persuader, said Blodwyn. You know, it's what Glynn calls those china eggs for encouraging hens to lay. Glynn bought one, you see, when he was at the exhibition, but he says he lent it to a friend of yours for a few days. Now, if your friend wants to keep it, I don't mind, but I don't want to get another if he's finished with it, you see? Don't worry, I said. It'll be in the post today. I'll see to that. Oh, ta, Tony. What was it you wanted to ask me? Don't bother, Blodwyn, I said. I think I know the answer now. Putting down the telephone, I went to the waste paper bin and put in my hand. Gladstone gave a shriek. Worthington whined anxiously. I took hold of the egg and brought it out. Oval, white, faintly shining, and as incapable of hatching out a young parrot as the china ashtray on the table. I let Worthington sniff at it, and he gave a snort of disgust. Well, Gladstone, I said, what have you to say? He lifted his right claw and scratched his beak. Or he may have been scratching his right claw with his beak. Then he cocked his head on one side and chuckled and said, smashing egg, isn't it, boyo? Any more nuts, then?
Gladstone's Happy Event, told by Anthony Bilbo, was written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo. Tomorrow's story is called Shut In.
It's 11 o'clock, and time now for another morning story with Anthony Bilbo. It's called Shut In.
Hello again. Helen Grant opened the front door of the fourth floor flat and, as usual, held it wide, ready for her husband Tom to rush out to catch his train. In her right hand, she held his umbrella and gloves. As usual, Tom came out of the kitchen carrying his cup of coffee and with his newspaper under his arm. He took a last sip at the coffee and, as usual, put the cup down on the hall stand, spilling a little on the polished surface. He took his overcoat from the hook and put it on without doing up the buttons, took two steps forward, reached Helen, took the umbrella and gloves from her, and bent his cheek for her kiss. Helen put her right arm round his neck. Kiss me properly, Tom, she said. Well, really, old girl, he said, I'm in a hurry. Yes, I know, Helen said. But she didn't let go. Tom looked puzzled. Then he gave her a quick hug and a kiss. There. That better, old girl? Yes, much better, said Helen. Goodbye, Tom.
Well, don't say it like that, old thing. I'm only going to Aldgate East, not the end of the world.
Helen smiled. Tom gave her cheek a pat before hurrying the few feet to the lift shaft. He pressed the bell and then turned and looked at her.
You feeling all right, old thing, he said.
Yes, I'm quite all right, Tom.
You sure?
Yes, quite sure. The lift arrived and the doors opened automatically. Tom hesitated a moment, then waved his umbrella and stepped into the lift. The doors closed and he was carried away. Helen continued to stand at the open door of the flat. What would Tom have said, she wondered, if she'd told him that he was never going to see her again, that when he came back from the office that evening, he would find her gone, gone away with another man. Helen strolled back into the kitchen, remembering to pick up Tom's coffee cup as she went. She washed up everything. Then she laid the table for one, for Tom's evening meal. She put very little conscious thought into the movements. They were the same ones she'd made almost every morning since she and Tom returned from their honeymoon nearly 5 years ago. 5 years. 5 years that had started so well, so full of hope, so full of the excitement and newness of being Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Grant. And now, what was left? Affection? Well, yes, a mild sort of affection. Otherwise, a life of routine and boredom. A life in which she felt shut in. A life in which each day was the same as the one before it, and Helen could predict to a second what Tom was going to say or do. If they'd had any children, perhaps she wouldn't have had time to notice how used to each other they'd become. Or at any rate, she wouldn't have let herself notice it. Breaking up a marriage when there are children to consider was quite another matter, she told herself. But as it was, there was only Tom and herself to think about, and of course, Brian. Brian was the man Helen was going to go away with. He'd said, better that one of us should be unhappy than that two of us should. And, put like that, it sounded reasonable. And anyway, Helen didn't believe that Tom would be unhappy when she left him. Put out, certainly, a bit embarrassed at having to tell the men at the office, but that was all. Helen looked at the clock, just 9:30. She had 5 hours before the train went. 4 hours at least before she needed to leave. Time for a nice, long, leisurely bath and to set her hair, time for a bite to eat afterwards, time to write a note to leave for Tom. All the time in the world in which to put into effect the decision that was going to change her life so completely. She started running the hot water and then collected up everything she was going to need for her bath. Now was the time to be extravagant with that expensive bath oil Tom had bought for her at Christmas. It would be too unkind to leave any behind to remind him of her. Sponge, flannel, nail brush, and the big white towel that Tom said made her look like a Roman statue when she wrapped it round her. Oh, Tom, how the simple, everyday routines of life wound themselves around you so that you didn't own a single object that could be called entirely your own and free of memories. She must think instead of the irritating, boring habits Tom had. She pushed the door to, and then, sitting on the edge of the bath, waiting for it to fill, she forced herself to think of Tom at breakfast that morning. Any morning. It was always the same. First, his morning paper. Then, his hand would appear from behind it and fumble for the spoon in the saucer. The searching fingers would locate it, and the disembodied hand would dip the spoon into the cup and stir round and round and round until she wanted to scream at him to stop. In fact, she had screamed at him often enough, but he simply didn't realise how it got on her nerves. And then, when he'd eaten his 2 pieces of toast, he would pick up his knife and start drumming with it on the plate. He didn't seem to know he was doing it, but Helen could tell from whether he drummed fast or slow whether he was in a good or bad mood. There really ought to be a way for girls who are thinking of getting married to find out what her prospective husband's more irritating mannerisms were, thought Helen. Oh, she wasn't conceited enough to think she didn't have mannerisms that annoyed Tom in return, but he at least went out to a job each day and got some variety into his life. Helen had gone out to work for the first year of their marriage, but the journey to town was so long and she was never able to have a meal ready for Tom in the evening, so he'd asked her to give it up, and she had. Yes, the bath was full enough by now. Helen tipped the last of the bath oil into the water and stirred it round with her hand before getting in. The smell of the oil rose and mingled with the steam, reminding her of the first time she'd used that particular scent. The first time she'd met Brian. Brian, handsome, successful, determined. A man who was used to making decisions, who had no patience with people who couldn't make up their own minds. It was that quality of decisiveness that had first attracted her to him. And it was that same quality of decisiveness that had forced her to her own decision to leave Tom. Just under a week ago, he'd said it. Helen, I'm not going to say we can't go on like this, meeting for these ridiculous morning coffees and afternoon teas, because you know it can't go on like this. We're not a couple of school kids. I love you, and you love me. You don't love Tom. I want you to come away with me. Then Tom can divorce you and we can get married. We're going to Manchester next Thursday. Not a very romantic sounding place, I'm afraid, but I've been offered a better job up there. It's a splendid opportunity, and we'll be right away from London. Helen had opened her mouth to ask him for more time to think it over, but Brian had put a hand on her arm warningly. No, I don't want to discuss it, Helen. If you're coming, be at Euston Station at the barrier for the Manchester train between 2:15 and 2:25. No, say 2:30. I'll give you till 2:30 in case you have trouble with traffic. If you're not there, I shall catch the train anyway, and you'll never see me again. No, Helen, I don't want any discussion or what am I going to do about Tom. You can do all that by yourself. I've done all mine, and I know what I want. I want you. It hadn't taken Helen long to make up her mind. Faced with a straight choice between life with Brian and life with Tom, there seemed only one possible answer. She didn't even feel guilty at the thought that she was going away with Brian that afternoon. Guilt. A dreadful, heavy word. But it didn't seem to have any meaning for her. Her life with Tom made her feel shut in. Life with Brian meant excitement, change, and a man who knew his own mind. A man who got things done. Tom, on the other hand, could never get to grips with anything. Ask him to do the simplest little job round the flat, and it would be 3 months before he started to think about it. There was the washer on the tap in the kitchen, the loose leg on one of the chairs in the dining room, the lock on the bathroom door. Helen suddenly became aware that the water in the bath was getting cold. She pulled out the plug and stood up, wrapping the big white towel round her. Then she stepped out onto a mat shaped like a large blue footprint. And all the time, she was pretending to herself that she wasn't feeling alarmed. "Now don't panic," she said aloud. 2 steps to the door. She gripped the round handle and turned it. It spun easily, but the lock stayed locked. She pulled hard and the handle came right off. The door was like a blank panel in the wall. She was shut in, literally. At first, Helen felt rather amused. It was like a scene out of a French farce. People didn't lock themselves in the bathroom in real life. At least, even if they did, it was easy enough to get out. But the longer she looked at the door, the more solid it seemed. "Now, let's see," she thought. "I came in here at 10 o'clock. Say I've been in the bath 30 minutes. Well, a bit longer, probably. Add a bit for the time I spent filling it. And it can't be more than 11 at the latest. 11, 12, 1, 1:30. 2.5 hours to get free, to get dressed and made up, to write a note to Tom, and to get out of the flat. Oh, yes, plenty of time. All I need to do is to think this out calmly." She forced herself to sit down on the edge of the bath again. There was no point in wasting time on the door. It was heavy, and it was solid. Not much use shouting, either. These flats were efficiently soundproofed. Helen got up and opened the bathroom window. Opposite was the blank wall of another block of flats. Not a window in sight. A narrow passageway below, full of dustbins. But this was the 4th floor, and even if it was the day for the bins to be emptied, it was unlikely that anyone would hear her if she called down. Well, she couldn't knot towels together and climb down. There were only 2 of them, and 1 was small anyway. Scratch a message on a piece of soap and throw it out of the window? "Help, I am a prisoner in my own bathroom." No, nobody'd find it. That was ridiculous. She grew thirsty and filled her tooth mug with water from the cold tap. Could you really get poisoned from drinking from the hot tap? Or was it one of those old wives' tales you were told about when you were a child, like the one about your sins finding you out? But it wasn't a sin to go off with Brian. It was the most natural thing in the world, wasn't it? Perhaps there was something in the bathroom cabinet that would help her to force the lock. She opened the looking glass front of it and looked inside. Tom's razor, his toothbrush, a packet of blades, and the bottle of aftershave lotion she'd given him for his birthday. Some aspirins in a bottle. A dried up piece of soap. Suddenly, these ordinary articles had something pathetic about them. She'd already removed her own odds and ends that had taken up two-thirds of the available space. And without her things, these looked lonely, deserted. Well, this was just the sort of sentimental thinking that Brian would scorn the most, and Helen knew it. And somehow, it was in realizing that, that she realized something much more important. She was relieved that the decision had been taken out of her hands. She couldn't get out to get to Euston Station, and she was glad of it. Stolen half hours with Brian had been one thing, a lifetime with Brian, a lifetime of a man who knew his own mind and had no patience with people who didn't know theirs. What a terrifying thought it was. You'd never know where you were with a man who would suddenly decide to go away with another man's wife, a man who wouldn't even think twice about it. He could decide just as suddenly to leave you and go off with somebody else. Helen Grant didn't know what the time was, and she didn't care. She stood up and addressed the door. All right, she said, you win, and I hope you're satisfied. She stamped her foot on the floor, emphasizing her words. And the bathroom door swung open. With an odd feeling of detachment, Helen thought, I must tell Tom that's the way to open it. She walked into the passage and along to her bedroom. Now that she was away from the steamy atmosphere of the bathroom, she was cold with only a towel round her. As she dressed, she glanced at the alarm clock. 12:30. Plenty of time to get to Euston if she still wanted to. But she didn't want to. At 1:00, the telephone rang. It was Tom.
Helen, old girl, are you all right? I was worried about you this morning. You seemed a bit peaky.
I wasn't quite myself, Tom, said Helen, but I've pulled round now.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, by the way, Tom, the lock went on the bathroom door again. I was locked in for nearly 2 hours.
Oh, I am sorry, said Tom. I've been meaning to mend it. I'll get down to it first chance I can.
Well, when you get round to it will do, said Helen. There's worse things can happen than being shut in.
That story, Shut In, was told by Anthony Bilbo and was written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo. Tomorrow's morning story is called A Rotten Stuck-Up Lot.